fascinating facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
A very happy Friday to you. It's great to be with you as we kick off the weekend on the Cale Clark Show. Here's the phone number to call, toll free to talk to me or my guest. Well, I will introduce in just a moment. 888-914-9149 is a toll free line to call. Sponsored by the Catholic Order of Foresters Life Insurance. 888-914-9149. You can also find me on the X app at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. You can also email the program. Love to hear your feedback. Become a shadow producer. Send me a show idea. The address is Cale, C-A-L-E, at relevantradio.com. Well, today, March the 8th, of course, is hashtag International Women's Day. You probably saw a lot of posts about that on social media today. And I thought it was the perfect day to reach out to my guest today and ask her to appear on the program. And she very graciously said yes. She's a historian. She's an author, a speaker, an artist, and much more. Also a visiting professor at the Augustine Institute Graduate School in Denver. Her latest book is going to be released this month. It's available for pre-order now from Ignatius Press and the Augustine Institute. It's called Women of the Church, What Every Catholic Should Know. Dr. Bronwyn McShay is my guest today on the Cale Clark Show. And Dr. McShay, thank you so much for taking the time out to do this today. How are you?
I'm very well, Cale. Thank you for having me on the show. You can call me Bronwyn if you like.
Sure, sure. Right. We'll do. Bronwyn, let me start with this. Let me ask you about your superhero origin story, as it were. Where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up in a small town called Cornwall in the Hudson Valley in New York. Originally from Queens, New York, so I like to get that. I'm officially a New Yorker. My parents are from Queens, New York, so Woodside. So, I'm a New Yorker through and through, I guess.
Awesome. Growing up, what was your faith life like?
Mm-hmm. My parents raised my three siblings and me in the Catholic faith very steadily. My parents were devout Catholics, so we're all sort of cradle Catholics, kind of slightly more traditional Irish Catholic family than some. So I just grew up with the church just being very alive, and I always was drawn to the history of of the church, even when I was younger, in different ways through movies about, you know, great figures. And I love some of the old biblical epics from the 50s and things like that. So, yeah, my parents did a good job, and all my siblings are faithful to this day, and several are raising Catholic children. So, yeah.
That's incredible. And, in fact, you posted a photo on your Twitter account that your parents had sent you. They've always got the Ignatius Press catalog in the mail, and they sent you a picture of the catalog with your book featured there, Women of the Church, What Every Catholic Should Know. That must have been an incredible moment, sort of a surreal moment for you and a proud moment for them.
Yes, very much so. My mom sent me that, and they've gotten used to me publishing things and getting my name out there, but that was exciting to them. It's because it's one of these very ordinary things coming in the mail, and I always used to love going through that catalog.
Yeah,
so it's pretty cool for me too, as well as them, to see my book in the Ignatius catalog.
Yeah, that's absolutely incredible. And so you sort of alluded to this, Bronwyn, a couple moments ago. What sparked your interest in church history? You mentioned those biblical epics, the movies, like maybe the Ten Commandments, Ben Hur, that kind of thing. But was there anything else that kind of got you going?
Well, I mean, I was kind of a nerd as a child, as you can imagine, going into the profession. I loved the past. I found the past like very just fascinating, and I the idea that people were as alive as you and me, but living in very different times. And so I would just, my parents filled our house with a lot of books, including a lot of history books. We sort of have a history bug in my family. My brother actually teaches history at West Point at the moment.
So we
just have this sort of just fascination with history that I had even as a child that is not quite explainable. It just was there. And I thought I was going to become a lawyer when I got into good schools.
Oh yeah.
And then I had a professor luckily kind of suggest to me that, you know, maybe law isn't your path. You should consider grad school potentially And I'm just really glad I had a professor do that, because it really was the right decision. And I gradually came to feel like I had a professional calling to this, which was sort of distinct from my just passion for history growing up.
Yeah. So you had no inkling this would be your profession. You just were sort of just passionate about this.
I guess so. Yeah. I mean, I would, you know, read history books. I prefer them to novels most of the time. I think I did things as a child that suggested I should become a historian someday, but I didn't really have that many role models in this regard. Yeah. My background's pretty working class as well, so I had no professors in my life socially growing up, so I was not exposed to people making a career like that, except through books, you know, like names on books. So, and I did always want to write books. That I sort of imagined when I was younger. So, but it took sort of being trained by some really excellent historians to kind of show me that as a realistic possibility as a student.
That's amazing. They often say, like, if you take a kid at 8 years old, you read their, you know, what they would write in their yearbook, that's pretty much sometimes what they turn out to be in the end. So you did think of yourself maybe as a writer.
Yeah. But I don't know. I imagined my name on books at some point. So it took a long while to get my first book out after grad school. So, but once it happened, I knew it could be done, and here I am with my third book on the way now. So, and I have more to write. So it's something that I just feel I can't live without it in a way. I don't know why that is. It's just God made me that way for some reason. So, yeah.
You're just compelled to do it. I love that. My guest is Dr. Bronwyn McShay, and she's got a new book out called "Women of the Church: What Every Catholic Should Know." So you're an Ivy Leaguer. You did your undergrad at Harvard, and as you sort of alluded to, you were probably thinking of law maybe at this point, and the professor kind of said, maybe history is the way. Who was that professor?
Well, there were two. James Hankins was one of them, who actually blurbed this book for me, professor of Renaissance Studies. I had another young professor at the time named Lewis Miller, who's also a mentor in this way to me. So I studied with a number of great professors, but those two, I think, helped me kind of see this as a possible path forward. I did take the LSAT, but I never applied to law schools.
Okay.
And then I went to Harvard Divinity School and got a master's there because I thought I might want to go into religious studies versus history. So I did momentarily wonder about that, but it became clear to me during my master's program that I wanted to become a historian. Pure and simple, but I focused on the history of Christianity with Dr. Carlos Ayer at Yale, excellent historian and writer. So,
he was your doctoral supervisor at Yale. So, so you went from Harvard to Yale, stayed in the Ivy League. And by the way, you're the second Harvard grad that I've had on the show this week. So I feel like I'm already a lot smarter, twice as smart as I was on Monday. That's for sure.
And that's funny.
Well, I want to ask you about Carlos Ayer. And speaking of Ayer, he's got a book out which really intrigues me, and I haven't read it yet, but it's called They Flew. And you'll have to connect me with this guy later, because this is amazing. Before we get into your book, what is that one about?
It's a history of kind of supernatural events like levitation and bilocation. Dr. Ayer has always had a fascination with the fact that many of the historical sources that very, you know, secular materialist-minded historians work with are some of the same sources in the early modern period, medieval period, that will refer matter-of-factly to stories of the miraculous. And so he always, I remember when I was in grad school, he was imagining doing a book, something along these lines. He's produced a number of books since that time. So it's kind of special to see this book out there now, because his students, when I was there, we sort of knew he might want to do something like this. So it's basically an account of how scholars, both stories of particular important kind of miraculous events in the early modern period, and I think it goes into I actually don't have my copy in hand yet. It's upstate at my parents' house. It was shipped there,
okay.
So I have to go read it still. But it's both an account of events, but also consideration of how historians have written about such events, and how so he thinks about the relationship of faith to historical discipline in ways that I find very helpful.
Yeah, that is so intriguing. I'd love to get my hands on this as well. I'd heard about this mm-hmm. book, and then I saw on your feed that he was your supervisor, your doctoral supervisor. Mm-hmm. So that was fantastic. And well, let's talk about your new book. This is your third book, Bronwyn. First one was Apostles mm-hmm. of Empire, published by University of Nebraska Press, and it's all about the mm-hmm. Jesuits and New France. And I'm a Canadian. I live in Toronto, Canada, and of course, the history of Canada and New France. Was a big deal for me growing mm-hmm. up. So that's also amazing. And then your second book, which was published by Pegasus Press, came out about a year ago, called mm-hmm. La Duchesse. And and who is this about? Speaking of women of history, you got to say a couple words about this.
Sure. Yeah. And that's just so people are aware, the book came out last year. I was working on Women of the Church. While I was impressed, some people think, oh, how did you produce two books in 2 years? So it the processes sort of overlap. So I'm not that crazy. I can't produce them that quickly. So La Duchesse is the life of a 17th century French Catholic duchess named Marie de Vignerot. She was the niece and heiress of the rather Machiavellian Cardinal Richelieu, who was the prime minister of France for a time in the 17th century. And he was one of the wealthiest men in Europe, as well as one of the most politically savvy figures of his age. And, you know, every French school child knows about Cardinal Richelieu. Very few people know that one of his right hands was his niece, his sister's daughter, who's a very talented young woman whom he kind of helped raise after she was orphaned. And she became a kind of a mover and shaker in her own right, partly by inheriting his vast fortune and many of the powers and his political network he gave to her. She had more access to his sometimes secretive, widespread political network than his actual successor as prime minister, Jules Mazarin, who felt she was sort of a rival for power. But I came across her because she was one of the main patrons of the French Catholic missions in colonial New France in the 17th century. And I was interested in sort of the way Jesuits and other missionaries worked with lay elites, some of whom never went to North America, but were part of the history of Catholic evangelization in the 17th and 18th centuries. People don't realize that in those days, dukes and especially monarchs, sort of powerful lay figures really had to sponsor and get missions going, because bishops and popes didn't have the infrastructure to kind of start. They didn't have NGOs in those days, you know, like international nonprofit organizations. So religious orders had to depend on political power, merchant companies. So I sort of stumbled across her in that first project, and I just started coming across all these fascinating references to her in all different sources. And she was involved in so many things, founding missions all over the world, seminaries in France. She was one of the main patrons of St. Vincent de Paul, and she was one of the first major ladies of charity. She started schools, hospitals. She also was a literary patroness. She was sort of all over the place, and she was politically significant. And she was a devout Catholic who wanted to become a Carmelite nun when she was young. You know, I'd never really heard of her, and she started to seem like a rather major figure whose life should be turned into a book. The only book I could find about her was published in 1879.
Oh, my.
And it was full of some fictional things inside there. A lot of it was accurate. Some of it seems fictional. And I realized, you know, while finishing up Apostles of Empire, well, this could be a great book, because this is a woman from history who maybe should not have been forgotten.
Yeah.
Whose story should be told. So I dug into archives in France, and I brought her story back to life. And I love this book. It's kind of my pride and joy right now. So it took a long time to get it going. And Pegasus Books was fantastic to work with for this. They gave me a lot of color image pages and all that. It's kind of the sort of dream book when I was a girl that I imagined writing. This sort of looked like the kind of book I imagined when I was younger. So I'm very happy with it.
Yeah, telling her story, La Duchesse, from Pegasus mm-hmm. Press, and talk about a Renaissance woman. Mm-hmm. My goodness, that mm-hmm. and so you've really done her justice in this. And as you alluded to, this kind of overlap. There's overlap with your first book, Apostles of Empire, mm-hmm. and that one, and also with mm-hmm. your next book, which is coming out mm-hmm. this month, which we're going to talk about. We're going to take a quick mm-hmm. break right now with Dr. Bronwyn McShay, but we will be right back to talk about her new book, on International Women's Day, no less. It's called Women of the Church, What Every Catholic Should Know. I'm going to tell you what you should know about that right after this. 888-914-9149. Have a question for the good doctor? You can call in. 888-914-9149. Be right back. Hi, this is Cale Clark. Thanks for listening to my podcast. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. They're a pro-life phone company, and 5% of your monthly plan price goes to Relevant Radio or another pro-life charity of your choice. For a limited time, new customers who mention offer code Relevant Radio get a free phone with free activation and free shipping. Don't delay. CharityMobile.com. That's CharityMobile.com.
Explaining the faith so you can explain it to others. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Welcome back to the Cale Clark Show. I am talking with Dr. Bronwyn McShay about her new book, Women of the Church, What Every Catholic Should Know. It's part of the new series from the Augustine Institute and Ignatius Press collaborating on this, the What Every Catholic Should Know series. And Bronwyn, we've been hearing a little bit about your origin story, how you became a historian and a writer. What was the genesis of this particular book, Women in the Church?
Yes. Yeah, so during the pandemic, I was finishing up a postdoc at Princeton, and I was connected with the Augustine Institute, and I was hired to teach for them. I didn't really know much about them at the time, but I was looking for a teaching position of some sort, and I was very open to a Catholic institution as someone who takes my faith very seriously. And so I began, it was a pandemic situation, so I began teaching remotely for them. So I still am based in New York. They're in Denver, of course. And so the first course that I was suggested to me that I could possibly develop, partly because La Duchesse was on its way to coming out at that point, was a course on the history of women in the Catholic Church for the graduate students there. And so I put together a course and had a wonderful semester with students. And I since that time, started to teach more broadly in their church history survey teaching. But I got to teach that course, Women of the Church, again. And rather early on during that beginning of my relationship with the Augustine Institute, it was proposed to me that I potentially contribute a volume to this series, possibly based on my course in some way. So we sort of discussed different ways it could go. The book is sort of broader, more comprehensive than my course was initially, but it really grew out of that course for the Augustine Institute and also my increasing interest in the history of Catholic women writ large that La Duchesse kind of brought me to. So...
yeah, absolutely. And mm-hmm. Women of the Church is ranked as the number one new release in church history on Amazon. So you can pre-order it right now, of course, on Amazon. And as you noted as well, you posted a picture.
Is it this currently is, today, or is that a few days ago I posted that?
That was a few days ago. Yeah, I don't know what where it ranks today, but yeah, whenever you posted that a few days ago, and you also noted that it had overtaken the Bible for Dummies in another category. So that's always a good thing, you know. And let me ask you this. When you were teaching the course, did you sort of say, like, just by the way the students were reacting to this and getting into it, where you're like, okay, this could really work as a book?
Well, I didn't. When I was first coming up with the course, I wasn't imagining it as a book. But when the idea of contributing to this series was put before me, mm-hmm. it was very, very quickly I could imagine this as a book. The big challenge, though, was that it's a series. The books are all roughly the same size. Mm-hmm. And I was allotted, I think, 60,000 words, which would make it sort of the fattest book in the series.
Yeah.
And I have written books. My previous books were well over, the manuscripts are well over 150,000. So I got really kind of nervous.
Yeah.
Like, how could I write about all these women in that space? So that was the main challenge. But I definitely knew that I wanted to do a book like this and that I could. So so that was
trying to get 2,000 years of church history, you know, kind of condensed into 60,000 words. That is a challenge. And you talk about a lot, like the broad sweep of church history. And I'm really looking forward to reading this book. But some of the previews that and you posted an image of this as well. It seems like you've traced the history of the church through the history of women in the church, like through various ages of the church, the patristic age, the age of the fathers, the medieval times, if you will, the Enlightenment, the age of American ascendancy, to our own time. Let me ask you this. What is your favorite age to study when it comes to women in church history?
Well, I mean, the period that I'm most trained in is the early modern period, so roughly the 16th through the 18th century into the early 19th. So that period I knew best going to this project, and so the challenge was to keep that portion of the book in a balanced versus the others. I love learning new things. You know, historians, we sometimes, the hazard of our profession is that sometimes people think we know all of history of all time. You know, I'll get obscure questions. So, but, you know, we have to learn a lot outside of our field. So I enjoyed learning about, I didn't really know all that much about the American scene so much. I had done work in colonial North America. So some of the both well-known American women saints, people on their way to being beatified, some of the lesser known African American women who were on their way to being beatified. I learned, I just really enjoyed learning the stories of many women, that some of whom I'd heard of, and then trying to figure out how they fit into this larger picture. But really, each era is fascinating to me in very distinct ways. So,
That's fantastic. Yeah, I do think it's probably true. Most people, you're a historian. You must be a walking Wikipedia of sorts. I could ask you about anything, and you're going to just give me a lecture.
You can Google that. I tell people sometimes, I don't know the answer. Google faster than I am.
Yeah, you got to do a little bit of your own homework here. That's for sure. well, let's go to the phones. My guest is Dr. Bronwyn McShay from the Augustine Institute, the author of the new book, Women. Of the church, women, not women in the church, but they are in the church as well. Women of the church, what every Catholic should know. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Dee Dee in Phoenix. Hi, Dee Dee.
Hi, Cale.
Hi, good to have you back.
My question, thank you. Well, I'm sitting here totally fascinated. I'm going to order the book. But anyway,
great.
My question to the doctor is, who are some of the women featured in your new book, and why?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's some major names that people will know. The women doctors of the church all get major representation. So St. Hildegard of Bingen, Catherine of Siena, Teresa of Avila, Therese of Lisieux, a number of other very famous saints get sort of a lot of space. Joan of Arc, in modern times, Mother Teresa is featured. I talk about people who are not canonized, who I think are very important historically, who get some space. That's why, as a historian, I'm not necessarily writing a book of the lives of the saints, but about Catholic women of the church, as I call them, whom I think every Catholic should know. So those would include someone like Maria Theresa of Austria, one of the most powerful Catholic women in all of history. You know, she was a Catholic, a Habsburg empress in the 18th century. She reformed the church in her era in certain ways. So she's in there. Isabella of Spain, you know, who started the Inquisition, as well as connected to Christopher Columbus. So she's in there. Modern times, I have there's so many people. I actually counted. There's over 360 women mentioned by name or groups. There's various martyrs from different periods, the women who were martyred during the French Revolution, the Carmelite martyrs of Compiègne, who were on their way to canonization. So I try to get balance between kind of more developed portraits of women, including very famous ones that I think every Catholic should certainly know, that kind of represent and really show us some of the history of the church through their stories in key ways. But then I kind of broaden out and connect them to the stories of other women who might get just a paragraph, or in a few cases, just a sentence or two, that are part of a description of the history of women's religious life, or the history of women's lay organizations, or how women were responding to the Protestant Reformation or the French Revolution, or the challenges of the industrial era with poverty and all that. So it's kind of a tour through the history of the church and the history of civilization as the church is intertwined with it, with very famous women represented and less famous that I want everyone to be aware of. I mean, I had to make some tough choices. Certain people mm-hmm. didn't get as much press as others based on kind of the whatever goal I had. So hopefully that answers your question. The table of contents is visible online, so people can see that. But not every woman who gets a lot of attention is her name. It doesn't necessarily appear in the table of contents. So,
yeah, it's quite a tour, and it is a tour de force through church history by Dr. Bronwyn McShea. She's my guest today on the Cale Clark Show. If you have a question for Dr. McShea, you can call in 888-914-9149. She's the author of the new book, Women of the Church, What Every Catholic Should Know. And you know, Bronwyn, very often we're told that in the church, women had things that they didn't really have in secular society at the time. Mm-hmm. We're often told that the first CEOs, if you will, who were women, were Catholic nuns who founded religious orders, hospitals, etc. Mm-hmm. But lay women, and I think you bring this out in your book, lay women were also incredibly crucial in church history, weren't they?
Yes, they were. And I think they're a bit invisible to the like modern way of looking at things because of some of the ways in which they exerted a lot of influence. For example, there were a number of rather powerful queens who were either monarchs themselves or were consorts of Catholic monarchs or duchesses who had large domains. And people in positions like that in the old days for many centuries, they had a lot of say in who would be pastor of the churches in their domains, who would be a bishop even. Wow. Like the Vatican didn't choose bishops, most bishops, didn't select the men who would be bishops, like the great majority, until after Vatican I. So there's this whole, through much of the history of the church, people that I call in shorthand lay elites in the church really were involved with shaping the church. And in many cases, women played roles. Sometimes they were unofficial if they influenced decisions of fathers or uncles or things like that. But in many cases, they had more direct say, even in the institutional history of the church, mm-hmm. beyond what we would think. Many of them also better documented, easier to see, helping establish religious orders, or some noble women eventually become abbesses of communities that they founded with their patronage. Yeah, there's just a whole world of, because of the way society was set up in different periods and places, you have to sort of look, get past certain categories that we have today as modern people to sort of see some of this in the past.
Well, you recently, Dr. McShea, you recently gave a lecture at Belmont Abbey called mm-hmm. When Church and State Were United. Now, I mean, we obviously had the State of the Union address last night, and this concept of the separation of church and state is obviously... Mm-hmm. It's come to the forefront once again. But When Church and State Were United, that's kind of a provocative title. The role of powerful lay women in historical Catholic regimes, is that sort of along the lines of what you're talking about there?
Well, I was illustrating that. The program I was invited to speak for has an interest in the history of politics and constitutional order. So I thought I was being a little provocative given some of the students I thought might want to come to that. And, you know, If your audience wants to know, I'm an American who believes in separation of church and state here, but many of my dearest friends are integralists. So I don't know. So it's not, I don't favor marriage of church and state, but as a historian, the time periods I know best, mm-hmm. the unions of church and state, churches and states are just the predominant mode. And you really cannot understand the history of the church without a really kind of healthy understanding of what that meant on the ground, and it produced a lot of good things as well as bad things over time. So
what were some of the good and bad things you think came out of that?
Well, I mean, just an example drawn from my book, La Duchesse, Marie de Vignerot. She's a very powerful woman with a lot of money who had the ability to install people into diplomatic offices in the French diplomatic corps who she thought would be good Catholics and do good things. So she was able, because she was close to the King of France, to actually purchase the French consulates in North Africa, you know, where normally just secular men would have those posts, and their role was to basically focus on mercantile activity with the Ottoman Empire. but she installed Vincentian clergymen in those posts, and that was sort of a beachhead for missionary activity. So St. Vincent de Paul is known for having expanded his congregation of the mission and his missions to the poor into North Africa, helping galley prisoners and enslaved Christians in North Africa. And the Duchess, because she's connected to the French state, was able to kind of get this going. Without her, he could not have done that. Also, many of the charitable hospitals, the establishments of seminaries and Catholic institutions that we take for granted in the history of the church were authorized first by the crowns of various Catholic countries, and then they're sort of approved later by the papacy or by the bishops. So there are many, many. It's really a complex tapestry of institutions and religious orders and things we take for granted as part of our Catholic heritage. And there is a secular side of the church. I don't see the secular activity in those earlier centuries as separate from the church. It's kind of a dimension of the church that we need to be more cognizant of. And that just fascinates me as a historian, trying to understand what that was and what it looked like.
Yeah, it truly is fascinating. My guest is Dr. Bronwyn McShay. Her new book, Women of the Church, What Every Catholic Should Know. Let's take a phone call, 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. Let's go to Aaron in Winters, California, in NoCal. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, can you hear me?
Sure can, yeah, loud and clear.
Okay, great. Thank you. And so my question is, I know many of the doctors of the church women were mystics rather than scholars, and I wanted to, you know, get your comment on that. And then also, what would you say to women of today as part of the body of Christ of the church? What is our strength, and how can we be most useful in the church?
Wow, well, the second question is a big one. There are four women doctors of the church. Hildegard of Bingen, the most recently elevated as a doctor of the church, she was very much a scholar. She was interested in scientific questions, high-level theological considerations about creation and relationship to God. Pope Eugene III, in her day, approved of her theological writings. So she was considered a scholarly person in her own era. And she stands out. There are several women up who may be made doctors of the church at some point. Gertrude the Great or Edith Stein were very much scholarly women. So the relationship of mysticism to the writings of the women doctors of the church, it's one of the few ways in which these women were sort of seen as authorized and acceptable, because women, of course, could not be professors of theology in universities the way Thomas Aquinas was, women, because they didn't have the ability to teach theology formally, their authority had to come from somewhere else, I think, in order to be elevated by the church as teachers of the church. So that's one reason the mystic dimension is so key for the women who've been chosen. It's partly a matter of just the historical development over time. In modern times, of course, women are in positions where they're teaching. And so, you know, a couple centuries from now, we may have doctors of the church who were university professors or were teaching publicly, the way a number of the men who are doctors of the church were able to in their time periods. But as to women today, I know so many, it's a hard question for me to answer. I think women's strength today, it's so diversified. I just think of a strong Catholic women in my own life, you know, mothers of children, ranging from mothers of children to friends of mine who are also, you know, single, not married, who are doing amazing things for organizations like Catholic Charities or in the universities where they're teaching, women who are consecrated, women who are living sort of hidden, good Catholic lives, working all sorts of professions. And it's almost dizzying the different avenues that women have today and they're very much needed in so many sectors, and the particular gifts women can bring you know, with I'm hoping this book, I erred on the side of variety and mm-hmm. all sorts of kinds of women, partly with the hope that, you know, younger Catholic women, I didn't know nearly all of these stories when I was growing up. I wish I had known about some of these figures when I was younger. Mm-hmm. And I have young nieces, you know, and I suspect my nieces and other young women I know will go into all sorts of vocations and professions or not professional life or different things. And that there will be examples in this book that will inspire a variety of kinds of women. And I think men should read the book too. You know, it's not just for girls to read.
Yeah.
But yes. So.
And that's a good point. Like, representation matters. And mm-hmm. you even, I think, give an anecdote early in the book about how when you were younger, you're reading things like Augustine's Confessions, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and then you discover Teresa of Avila's writings. And you're like, man, this is like just as compelling in many ways.
Yeah, that's why I bring this up in the intro of the book. I loved Augustine. I read him in college. He's sort of still one of my main influences, I think, in the way I think. I was then exposed to Teresa of Avila's writings as a graduate student at Yale, not in a religious setting, but in the context of, you know, historiography and the history of early modern Europe with Carlos Ayer and other professors. And I was just blown away. And I had not been exposed to Teresa of Avila's writings when I was younger. I mean, turns out my parents had a book of hers on their shelf. I just never took it off the shelf when I was younger. So it's not like it wasn't there, but I just didn't have this sense until graduate school of the power and variety of some of the Catholic women in history, that I had a strong sense of some of the great male figures. I also always loved Thomas More, for example. In the book, I talk about his daughter, Margaret,
yes, Margaret
More
Meg.
Roper. It's just a wonderful human being. And so fascinating figure. So I wish I had known more stories about some of these women, like in their kind of three dimensions. I mean, I certainly knew various saints, but I had sort of two-dimensional senses of them, and they seemed very, very above me and not something that I could be like. Whereas some of the male figures, the way they're presented in books and movies, they seem more dynamic and kind of relatable somehow. That's just my own experience. I don't know if it's generational or not, but so it's one of the reasons I decided to write this book, to make sure that others get a shortcut to these stories and don't have to go through the years I went through of not knowing some of them.
Yeah, and like G.I. Joe says, knowing is half the battle. And just knowing about these women might spark even more studies. You said more research into their lives. There are just so many great women of church history that are mentioned in this book, Women of the Church, What Every Catholic Should Know. We'll be back with much more with the author of this book, Dr. Bronwyn McShay, right after this break. 888-914-9149. If you have a question for Dr. Bronwyn McShay, 888-914-9149. We'll be right back.
Helping you keep your mind off traffic and on the more important things in life. It's Cale Clark on Relevant Radio.
Hey, welcome back to the program. My guest is Dr. Bronwyn McShay. She's the author of the new book, Women of the Church, What Every Catholic Should Know. It's available for pre-order right now on Amazon and also on Ignatius Press's website. It's International Women's Day, and it's great to be talking to you, Bronwyn. And I'll tell you what, not only are you a historian, not only are you a professor, but you're also a woman of many talents. In fact, you can do this. Let's check it out.
Beneath that snowy mantle, cold and clean, the unborn grass lies waiting for its coat to turn.
Pretty good stuff. That's pretty good stuff. I was deep into your Twitter account there to find that.
I'm a little embarrassed, but yes, I do love to sing, and yeah. I'm very new at the guitar, but I try.
Oh, well, I thought that was awesome. And the reason why I wanted to play that especially is because that, of course, is the famous song "Snowbird" from Anne Murray, which came out in 1970. But I'm from Nova Scotia, Canada, originally, and so. She's like the favorite daughter of our province.
Excellent. Okay.
So I was touched to hear that. That was awesome. So, and you're also an artist too, on her website, bronwynmcshay.com. And that's spelled Bronwen McShay, MCSHEA.com. You can find some. You're into art as well. Like you seem to be into photography, a little bit of painting, maybe.
Yeah, I always actually another thing I loved when I was younger was painting and drawing, and I did consider becoming an artist, but I had a sense that that would be a very unstable career path if I chose that. So I chose history, a real
you
money
chose the arts.
I actually had a couple paintings in a small show here in New York this past year, which is pretty exciting. But I have not been able to devote the time to painting and drawing that I. At some point, I hope to do more of it. It's really a joy in my life, but I don't have the space for it these days that I sometimes wish. But
I was just gonna say the samples on your website look great. I think you have some great talent there, and as they say, you know, as one of my professors used to say, oh, the humanities, you know, it's tough out there in the humanities as well. And let me ask you this question too, because there are probably people listening, maybe some younger people who are doing their undergrad, and just as you were sort of directing, you know, maybe you should think about history. There are a lot of people who would say, don't study the humanities. There's no job market. It's tough to get to become, say, a tenured professor. What would you say to somebody who maybe has a passion and is thinking about going down that path?
I mean, I would be very sober and say it is tough, and I'm seeing success with my publications, but I have not had stability in my career. I've taught short term for a number of institutions over the years. And that's just a mix of European history, and my field was sort of shrinking at the time that I hit the job market looking for a tenure track professorship. Also, I don't know. I mean, I try not to assume the worst, but, you know, it's fairly easy to figure out. I'm a devout Catholic and, you know, don't necessarily share all the pieties of more typical academics. And so I don't know how that's affected. It's hard to trace that, and I don't blame anyone. But it is an unstable career, and I still in some ways experience that instability. I went into it because I really love studying history, and I do love teaching. I love writing. Mm-hmm. And without that passion, that kind of gets you through some pretty difficult stretches. I would not advise it unless you really feel some sort of burning desire in one direction. You may not know exactly what you want to write or teach, but going into it with eyes wide open is a good idea. I was fortunate to get into some excellent schools, so that protected me long term in terms of getting research fellowships and funding overseas for my books and all that. So there, at the same time, there's other opportunities opening up in our, there's all these, you know, classical Catholic schools opening up that need teachers. There are different programs being established at different universities around the country. For certain fields, kind of, I think are benefit from that a bit more than others. History is not necessarily a field that is benefiting it from a tremendous amount. At least not yet anyway. So I would just encourage young people thinking of going down a scholarly path to really pray about it. Make sure, like, see that if God is calling them toward that, you should be very open to it, because He'll find ways to kind of open doors for you, even if not everyone out there wants to open doors for you. But at the same time, you know, maybe a more practical decision is a good thing. I mean, I don't have a family, so I'm not worried about making money to feed children, you know, so I'm able to kind of get by and kind of do what I love to do. But I mean, people have all sorts of considerations, right? So
It's a complicated answer, I guess, in question for people. It's something certainly for prayer, but I like what you said. You know, it reminds me of something that Jesus is quoted as saying in the book of Revelation, hey, what doors I open, no one can shut. And what I shut, no one can open. So he can make a way if this is your path. And certainly prayer, spiritual direction, I think that's a big part of it as well. We're going to take a phone call right now for Dr. Bronwen McShay. Let's go to Lee in Florida, near St. Augustine. Speaking of St. Augustine, very close to St. Augustine, Florida. Hi, Lee.
Hello, how are you doing?
Great
show.
Thank you. What's your question, Lee?
Yes, my question is, I was at the Catholic Church, in Bahrain in 2001 when the Pope came in, and I would like your opinion on the influence that the women in the Catholic Church and the nuns had in the Middle East and maybe Africa. And
That's a great question. The influence of Catholic women in the Middle East.
Yeah, that's something I touched on that only briefly here and there. I have some stories in my book about some of the first women missionaries in the 19th century, actually established missions in the Middle East, some French nuns. And I'm embarrassingly blanking on the name of their order.
That's okay.
It's a long name in French. but Saint Emily de Villar is the saint who founded the order. They had communities and hospitals in parts of North Africa, but also in the Middle East. They were welcomed by Ottoman imperial authorities into these contexts. And, you know, there were certainly missionary women who went into parts of colonial Africa in the 19th century and early 20th. And what's sort of fascinating there is that even so, the French government, very secular, didn't necessarily like Catholicism anymore at this point, but they recognized how important nuns and priests as well were in terms of staffing hospitals and schools and kind of building up some of the infrastructure of the kind of European style societies they were doing there. And very often missionaries are they're on both sides of the complexities of colonialism, sometimes kind of challenging colonial authorities and the way things are done, sometimes kind of serving colonial empires in different ways. I don't know. There have been some women kind of martyred in the Middle East in recent times. I closed the book with a few examples of sisters of Mother Teresa's order who died as martyrs in Yemen. So I can only speak to the few examples that I know about that I brought into the book, but there's much more to that story than I get into. I kind of barely scratched the surface there. So I'm hoping others, you know, dig in further, and there's good readings they can look into beyond what I cover. So.
Wow. That's incredible. Yeah. And there's so much there. We only have about 90 seconds left with Dr. Bronwyn McShay. So let me ask you just this question. Where can people find you online and learn more about your work?
Well, I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter. I guess we call it X now. I still call it Twitter. I'm on LinkedIn. I am on Instagram. I'm the only person, I think, with the name Bronwyn McShay. So if you see two accounts, tell me that's a fake account. So I'm also BronwynMcShay.com, my website. And then, of course, if you look on Amazon or Catholic Market, connected to the Augustine Institute, my books are being sold by different outlets. So I'm happy to I have people following me, interested in my work. You're welcome to follow me. Anyone out there. So
the one, the only Bronwyn McShay, thank you so much for Accept No Substitutes, but you got to order the book, Women of the Church, What Every Catholic Should Know, available from Ignatius Press. Also, you can get it on Amazon, of course. It's a great book, and what a great conversation. Thank you, Dr. McShay, for taking the time and for writing this really important book.
Oh, thank you, Kale, for having me. This was really delightful. Appreciate this.
Oh, likewise. God bless you, and happy International Women's Day. This is the Kale Clark Show. Jim Shaper produced. Patrick Kalog took your phone calls. Take it away, Michaela.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.